History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are always some stories waiting to be told if we'll only take the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we start down that road, we never know exactly where it's going to take us, but we know we'll be thankful for it. We're educated. We're entertained. So often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Every once in a while, we get to the end of our time here on the radio, and there's just too much left in a veteran story that we weren't able to squeeze in. That's what happened last time with Dick Grantham of Arroyo Grande, California, who just celebrated his 93rd birthday. We're going to get the rest of his story today, but before we dive back in with that Purple Heart recipient who survived a close call with a kamikaze nearly 75 years ago, we're going to hear from someone much younger. In fact, someone who's the same age now as he was when he joined the Navy. A young lady who's going to be responsible for many young people from her generation hearing these veteran stories. And that's one thing I've often had veterans bemoan over the years, that today's teenagers are unaware of what millions of Americans, many of them teenagers themselves, did in the past to secure and preserve our freedom. That sentiment is often shared in general terms, but I'm always encouraged when I meet someone who's an exception to that rule. And trust me, there are exceptions to that rule all over the country. Many of them are influencing others from their generation and changing perspectives on a daily basis. I've met some who are recording oral histories with veterans or finding creative ways to raise money for honor flights, even auctioning off the animals they've raised for FFA and devoting the proceeds to causes like that. But I want to introduce you to one teenager today who earned the highest honor the Girl Scouts give out, the coveted Gold Award. She did it by creating a database of the interviews with veterans that you hear on Hometown Heroes. Students throughout the state of California are going to have access to that database for decades to come. CaliforniaStreaming.org is the web address for that service. More about that in a bit, but I want you to hear from Katie Chen, a 17-year-old who's about to start her senior year at Clovis North High School near where I live in Central California.
So I took a world history class over the summer, and I learned about the major world wars, World War I, World War II, Korean War, Vietnam War. I understood, like, in the textbook about these wars because I've heard about them before on Hometown Heroes. And it's really cool to hear these specific veterans talking from a personal perspective about World War II. You know, in the textbooks, it's very general. It's very, like, thousands of soldiers, thousands of pilots, but Hometown Heroes, it's these specific veterans and it's the actual soldiers that they're talking about in the textbooks. So I really thought this project could not only impact people in my community, but could really bring awareness to what these veterans have done for our country and the difference that they've made for our country as a whole. And so by archiving the Hometown Heroes interviews into the California County Educational Technology Consortium database at CaliforniaStreaming.org. This will ensure that teachers and students will have access to the Hometown Heroes interviews, and so these students can have another sort of learning resource and can learn about World War II and some other major wars.
So you put in a lot of time on this, huh? What all did you have to do and how hard was it?
So to record metadata, I had to listen to 250 Hometown Hero interviews. And I had to listen for keywords such as the position that the veteran had. It may have been a soldier or a pilot or even a cook, so different kinds of roles. And then also like the squadron they were in or any major events that happened such as D-Day. I also had to determine if there was sensitive content and the age range that would be able to listen to these interviews.
Did you ever feel like maybe this is too big, this is too much, I don't know if I'm gonna finish this?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest challenges was not only completing the project, but balancing it with schoolwork and my life outside of school as well. I paced myself, so every week I would get a certain amount done. But in the long run, it was really humbling because it taught me to listen, to just sit down and listen. And sometimes it's the most valuable skill because that's like the best way to learn sometimes, to just sit down, slow down your life and listen to other people and the wise words that they had to say. And especially from these veterans who are starting to pass.
Was there a story that maybe even in an unexpected way really made an impact on you, that, you know, stood out among those 250 that maybe you even think about again after you listen to it, that just really made an impression on you?
So there's one episode about a Navajo code talker, and it really emphasized how rare the Navajo code talkers were and how they had to be well protected because they knew the language that not many people knew. And actually, we learned about that during history this year. And so to hear a story from a Navajo code talker was really cool. It was a story that came straight from a very valued, highly respected Navajo code talker. I think it made me just appreciate what we have now because of what the veterans have done for us. You know, some of our problems as teenagers right now, such as if we have cell service or our Wi-Fi, you know, stuff like that, that's compared to what some of these college age, even younger than college age veterans went through at close to my age or even like tiny bit older, it's way more serious and way more impactful than what many of us go through now. And so it was very humbling to listen to all that and hear that.
What do you hope other people get out of the work that you've done and the time you put in?
So I hope that students my age and even people of all ages will be able to better realize and better appreciate our veterans and have so much more respect for them as I gained throughout this process.
How long did this take you?
This project probably took me about a year and a half.
Was that worth it? A year and a half of a teenager's life? I mean, I'm sure your friends were doing some other things when you were sitting there listening to all these old people talk.
It was definitely worth it because it was a different way of learning about life and about history. It definitely made me better appreciate the freedoms we've had and also just how much our country has changed over the time, and it didn't happen easily. We went through so many struggles to get where we are today, and as cliche as it sounds, but if those young veterans could make a change back then people my age can make a change now.
And she already is. That is Katie Chen. And to better understand the significance of what she's done with all the hours invested in that online database, let's hear from John Lenko with the California County Educational Technology Consortium, who had the idea to incorporate Hometown Heroes into CaliforniaStreaming.org, that task that Katie turned out to be the perfect person to accomplish.
Well, I've been a listener to the Hometown Heroes show for a long time, and it struck me early on that this is something that students needed to know about. Unfortunately, not many young people listen to AM radio, and I listen to Hometown Heroes on KNZR AM here in Bakersfield. So that's where the idea first came to me, is we need to share this. And the avenue that we have is through California Streaming. That's an online digital resource library shared by county offices throughout the state of California. So we looked to add the best of the best to that library, and I knew Hometown Heroes was that.
So what is California Streaming, and who uses it, and what's the point?
California Streaming is an online digital resource library. And in a nutshell, what that is a 21st century version of the old county film checkout library that we knew of 50 years ago, right? All those resources have now been digitized and are delivered online. It's run by a consortium, the California County Educational Technology Consortium, that is a big, long name for a partnership, a JPA, that is 15 county offices of education. They've pooled their resources to purchase and acquire the best media resources to share with their classrooms. And all of that content is vetted by California educators, aligned to California state standards, aligned to Common Core standards, viewed and reviewed for that specific content that teachers need to use in their classroom.
So what are some other examples of maybe resources that are in that database that get accessed a lot?
There are thousands of video resources, audio resources, print, and photographs, all digitized and indexed to be searchable by teachers. So all different subject areas, all grade levels, thousands of images, and thousands of elements in that library. About 8,000 different pieces of information in there.
And how much of that would relate to World War II history?
We have a robust history section, but we've had to work to find the content like Hometown Heroes, for example. We filter all of the different programs and we review them, but we really did not have a resource like Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes gives those in-depth, first-person, primary source interviews. Frankly, Paul, there's not another program like Hometown Heroes that we found. And that's why, to me, it was so very valuable to bring it to the consortium for their consideration and review.
But it never would have been reality if there didn't appear someone to do the work, right? I mean, how significant was the work that was done here to make it fit that system?
Hometown Heroes represented a very large collection to add to our library. And in order for the users of that library to be able to find that content, it has to be indexed so that there are metadata and keywords associated with each episode that sends a user to that specific episode. And that work takes a lot of time. Those programs are an hour in length in the broadcast version, which is about 48 minutes in length total. That means that someone has to go through and filter each of those, listen to every episode, and mark down those keywords. What standards does it meet in California? What keywords are associated with that? What grade level? All those things need to be linked to each and every episode. And that represents a lot of work. And we did not have anyone prepared to do that work until you introduced us to Katie Chin.
Did you think that she could do it? I mean, this is a high school girl.
Well, we had never had a high school student participate with us in this fashion. We were willing to give it a try. So we trialed it with her. We did a test of a half a dozen episodes so that she would understand what she was getting into. And she did a superb job. She was great.
What impressed you the most about what she did or how she did it or how quickly she did it?
Her dedication to the project and the work. She held a great respect for the work that you've done with Hometown Heroes and what Hometown Heroes represents. And she has a very great determination to see a task through once she starts it. Once she started into it, and the other thing I appreciate about her, Katie, I'm jumping ahead, but she's very coachable in what she did. She wanted our feedback, and we guided her in finding those keywords and performing that work. Early on, she became very skilled at doing this work. So it was a lot of work. She has over 300 hours. She indexed 250 episodes, and she's probably got over 350 hours worth of her time in that. We tried to make it clear what she was getting into, but I'm not sure that she knew right off the bat what all was going to be involved. But she quickly saw that and rose to the occasion. She did a great job.
And we both got to see her receive that gold award from the Girl Scouts. She's done just about everything you can do as a Girl Scout. But how would you explain the potential impact of what she's done and what you hope it leads to or turns into? What is she giving to other young people throughout the state? And maybe even how many young people will have a chance to benefit?
She's unlocked the Hometown Heroes collection to students for use throughout the state of California. And the value to me of Hometown Heroes is it provides students with that primary source information. You've gone and found those interviews. Many of the veterans you've interviewed are no longer with us now. So where are students going to go to get that in-depth primary source interview that they would ask a veteran, were they doing a History Day project or some involved report? They don't have access to that now with those veterans gone, but they do through Hometown Heroes. And Katie has unlocked that resource to those students and educators from here on out in California.
Why does it matter? Why do you think those stories and those firsthand accounts matter? Why does it matter that young people have access to them?
You know, one thing that I've always appreciated about Hometown Heroes, Paul, is that when you interview a veteran, you don't just skip to their active service. You go in depth about how did they come to December 7th? What was their life like during the Great Depression? I know of no other collection, no other content that helps students understand what life was like during the Depression. And these students who are listening to Hometown Heroes now are about the age that the veterans were during that time. So that's very important. Also, what was their service after the war? A lot of those stories are lost during the Cold War, that type of thing. Plus, there's just a tangible element to being able to hear the words of the veterans in their own voice, to hear the emotion that often comes out in your interviews. That's all of very great value, along with the printed material that you've added to it. Photographs and unique mementos of those veterans all paint a picture of their individual stories. So I think all of that is important to students to understand, and much more than they get in an edited, for example, one-hour documentary about D-Day or something like that. There may be just one or two comments from different veterans. You spend an hour on each story and really get involved in the entire story of that person. And I think that is the great value of every episode.
What about carrying on what Katie started? Do you think that'll happen?
Paul, I know it's going to happen. Katie wrote an instruction manual for those who will follow in her footsteps. She was a groundbreaker because the entire consortium, and throughout the consortium, we had not had a high school student do this type of work. And she was a groundbreaker. She proved that this work can be done by high school students and graduate students. We've now taken Katie's initial program and extended it to some graduate students in other areas. But when it comes to the Hometown Heroes Collection, we've got a couple of hundred episodes yet to go. And we need to find that special person like Katie who's dedicated to that specific content. And we're on the lookout for that person. We're going to find them, identify them, and add the rest of Hometown Heroes to our library.
Well, maybe you know one of those people, or maybe you're an educator who would like to tap into that resource. Go to californiastreaming.org. Feel free to ask them for a free trial to test it out. And thanks again to Katie Chen and John Lenko for the time here on the radio, and more importantly, the time they and others have invested in making sure our veteran stories are heard by students in the Golden State for decades to come. For those of you listening in other states, maybe you can pull off something similar. All right, it's break time, but when we come back, we're going to catch up with Dick Grantham, now 93 years old, and a survivor of a kamikaze attack aboard the USS DuPage in 1945. If you missed the first part of his story last time, you can find it online at hometownheroesradio.com, along with more information about California Streaming. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. If you caught our last episode, you heard Navy veteran Dick Grantham discuss the incident that left him with a Purple Heart and a couple other lasting souvenirs that we're going to talk about. But we didn't have enough time to capture all of his story, so we get to hear more from him today. Just to catch up, let's hear his description of what it felt like when a Japanese Betty bomber came within inches of him as it crashed into his ship, the USS DuPage, on January 10th, 1945.
Like I was being barbecued in a microwave instantly, and I didn't know what was... My first indication was I thought maybe the 5-inch cannon on the fantail had backfired, so I didn't know. The heat was... He was so tremendous, that terrible, terrible, terrible heat. And I remember trying to get away from that heat, and I backed into this thing, a magazine. I thought, oh, there's bullets in there. I better get out of here. And oh, you think of a million things in split second that don't happen otherwise. And so I remember that we had, there's other guys that were trying to get down this one ladder. It goes down onto the fantail, and I figured these guys needed that ladder better than I did, so I climbed over the side, and it was about a 10-foot drop, and I dropped to the fantail, and because trying to get out of the heat was so horrible. I never felt any heat like that in my life, ever. I hope I never do again, but anyway, I remember there was guys jumping off the fantail there into the water, and I was about ready to jump in the water myself, you know, and because we thought the ship was going to sink, because the whole thing was nothing but fire. And so I looked over the side of that. It was nighttime, black, inky water there, and I thought of octopuses and sharks, and I thought, I'm going to try to stake my chance a little longer aboard of a chicken, I guess. And so it pays to be chicken. And the ship didn't sink, though. It pays to be chicken. So then the next thing I knew, I was in line. I don't know how I was got in line, but there's a guy behind me, a guy forward from me, and we were pushed along. And I remember I run into this one guy, and he says he's bleeding in the face. And I've had to have anchor. So I gave him my handkerchief, and then we all went midships. And that midships, there was a warrant bosun kind of directing traffic. And so he pointed, some of them he pointed down to go down, and the others he took pointed to go up, you know. And so when I came up there, pointed me down. And I at this time, you just follow orders. You don't know what's going on, you know. And so I went down, and lo and behold, I was in sick bay. And in sick bay, the corpsmen were overwhelmed, and there were stretchers to carry, or there was bandages to help guys get in, caught, and legs gone off, and it was horrible in there. So I started carrying stretchers and help bandaging stuff, helping. It was about 2 hours later, you know, and about 2 hours later, one time we were down there over the loudspeaker, they said that on this bomber, it was a bomber that landed on our twin-engine bomber that landed on our ship, and one bomb went off. The bomb that went off was about, 25 feet from where I was standing, but it went and it destroyed the whole gun crew except me. But anyway, there are a couple of heroes who go to throw the bomb over the side that didn't go off. And about 2 hours later, things begin to settle down pretty good. And so one of the corpsmen come by and he says, "Okay, Dick, it's your turn." And I says, "For what?" And he says, "Look at your arms." Well, from my waist on up, I was burnt and there was blood all over it. I didn't realize. Here I was working and doing stuff, and I didn't, I guess they call it suffering from shock or something. I didn't feel any. The pain I originally felt was that heat when the thing first went off. It's a horrible, horrible heat. That really hurt. But after a while, I was just busy doing stuff and carrying stretchers and bad. I didn't think about it. And here my arms are all bloodying. My upper part of my body was burnt. And so they put these big grease all over me, some kind of grease, and then bandages prop my arms up. So I couldn't even move my arms after that because the bandages kept my arms almost straight out. And so I couldn't do anything. So I was able to walk up to the bridge and up able to get to the bridge, but I couldn't do anything. I couldn't even move my arms or anything except for these doggone bandages that were up there. But that was it. And as far as pain goes, I think to this day, the one that really suffered was my mom. Kind of brings tears to my eyes to think about what my mom must have went through. And now that I have kids of my own, I just think, 17-year-old kid in a situation like that, and you get that telegram, must have almost killed her.
Well, and it definitely almost killed you, and it killed everybody else on that gun crew, as you said. And I read 35 members of your ship's crew were killed when that kamikaze hit, and 135 more wounded. But what we didn't get in that story is, where was this? And did you have any indication before it happened that this was about to happen or could happen?
No, we didn't. We'd already been in the invasion of Lingayen Gulf, and we didn't have any soldiers or anything aboard. And we were sailing down toward Manila, I guess it was. And that happened, and we were at general quarters, because we owe it to general quarters every evening automatically. And we were at general quarters, but we didn't know anything was happening till it happened. And that was it.
So where exactly were you standing when you felt that sudden, incredible heat sensation?
Well, I was right next to the gun. The other guy had sitting saddle on the gun, and the loaders, like me, were standing right there next to the gun, and that was it. And I didn't know anything was going on until later on I found out. I had a friend of mine that was on the signal bridge, and he had a 20-millimeter gun, and he told me that he saw his tracer bullets go into the cockpit. And apparently, when that, I guess the guy was aiming for the bridge. And so when his bullets hit him, I guess he automatically jerked back. Yeah. And that saved the bridge, except that on the signal bridge, it wiped out everybody but this friend of mine. But this other one, he was killed in the saddle there. And then from the bridge on back to the fantail on the port side was totally destroyed. And I do remember at a meeting one time later on with the honor flight that we had, we had a barbecue in the Pomo, and people had been on the honor flight. And this one speaker got up and started telling about his war experiences. While my son-in-law was with me, and I said, "Scott," I said, "that guy's telling my story." And then he says, "The port side of that ship was totally destroyed." Well, by that time, I walked up to the microphone, and everybody realized that there's a shipmate that I hadn't known for 70 years, and he was telling this story. And I says, "Well, it wasn't completely wiped out because I'm still here."
Holy cow.
So that was quite an experience in itself. But
so he really was from your ship, and you met him because you'd both been on honor flights with Honor Flight Central Coast, California.
Yeah. So, and it made the day for everybody there that the shipmate had reunited.
Well, and I was struck just as you told that last story, and I know we're kind of going over and over this, but I think there are a lot of elements of it that people would be interested in. So you said your friend who was up on the signal bridge on his 20 millimeter, that he shot the kamikaze. He had bullets going into the cockpit that redirected that bomber. Yeah. To where it hit you. So, if I'm understanding correctly, he may have saved the ship from sinking, but he almost killed you.
Yeah, I guess it might be, but that's another story. But anyway, he was one of my friends on board ship. He was on the gun crew on that, on the 20 millimeter. And I do remember the next invasion that we had. The ship was, we got some troops aboard, even though it was damaged, but going on a one more invasion. So I had still bandages and stuff on, but as a petty officer, they assigned me to a gun on the signal bridge, the one where the guy died in. And so they assigned me to that, and they said, being a petty officer, they assigned five guys with me, and they told me I could assign any one of them to get in the saddle of that gun, because I was a senior officer there, and I how could I tell some guy to get in the saddle where a guy just died? I couldn't do that, so hell, I'll get in it. And so I got in that saddle, and I tried to get in and out of the saddle in a hurry in case I had to. But I do remember we're going on in this next invasion, and and I remember I was kind of scared, but I was really scared that then. And I think if somebody had come behind me and said "boo," I'd have been spitting bullets out of that 20 millimeter. But it was a different story, really a different story. I could see, up on the signal bridge, I could see everything. I could see there were no clouds in the sky. It was a beautiful day, no clouds, no guns going off, no nothing. And we went in for this invasion, and we loaded the cargo nets down, and the soldiers got on, went down the cargo nets into the landing craft. Then they circled and out till they got loaded, and then the first wave went in to the landing, and I was watching all of them go in, and I could see the whole landing and everything. Then they turned around, and they started coming back, and what's going on here, you know? And then we found out that the guerrillas had already secured it, and so I didn't have to shoot that gun after all. And so then the DuPage went back stateside, but I was in the Commodore's staff. So the Commodore, he didn't stay with the ship. He just pops on another ship. So we went out to the USS Elmore, APA 42. So I had a lot of experience in Everson and the invasion of Okinawa. And there's the thing. So finally, now I'm in the ship's company, going to be hopefully on the helm in general quarters. And I thought, that's really great. Lo and behold, yes, I was at a helm. The only problem was there are three helms on the ship, the bridge, the fantail, and there's another helm in the steering engine room. And remember, I joined the Navy so I wouldn't be below decks. Well, the wheel I got was in the steering engine room, of all places. And above me was the laundry, and above the laundry was the fantail with a 5-inch cannon going off. So we're going to invasion, and all I could hear is that cannon echo down to me into the steering engine room, and I had sound-powered earphones on. And all I could hear was what's going on. And their first thing they said, again, into Okinawa, is 2,000 kamikazes coming at us. No, they said, no. First it said, kamikaze coming at it in force. And then they said, it's 2,000 kamikazes coming at us. That was scary to me, because here I'm below decks where I didn't want to be. And all I could hear is the sound powered earphones. And but anyway, after that, our ship went into dry dock in Everett, Washington. And we stayed there in dry dock till our ship was repaired. And I'm still on the Elmore, mind you, at this time. And we go out to sea, and we're in the middle of the Pacific Ocean at this time. We're headed for the invasion of mainland Japan. So anyway, now I'm in ship's company, which I liked better anyway. We were headed there, and all of a sudden, over the loudspeaker, the skipper on board, he says, the war is over. I dropped a bomb, you know.
And we're going to find out how they celebrated that news aboard Dick Grantham's ship when we come back. Remember, you can access photos and a short video of Mr. Grantham online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, wrapping things up now with 93-year-old Dick Grantham of Arroyo Grande, California. We've heard quite a bit of his life story, but there are a few twists and turns still to come. When we hit the break, he had just learned that World War II was over. His ship would not need to participate in the planned invasion of Japan because Japan had surrendered. So how do you think that news was celebrated aboard ship?
So the skipper gave us all a little free cup of ice cream for celebrating the war was over. And so I'm eating a little cup of ice cream, and later on in years, after I got out of the Navy and all, they first came out with television, then it came out with television. This is some time I'd been working for the phone company for a while, and they were showing VJ Day on television, and this VJ Day was Hollywood, and Sunset Boulevard, it was wall-to-wall people in this movie that we was watching. And in this wall-to-wall people, then they showed this lady dancing with this sailor there on Sunset Boulevard, you know. And I saw that, And I said, "Well, my God," I says, "Betty, get in here quick." She was in the kitchen at the time. I said, "Get in here quick." And it was Betty dancing with this sailor. So I look back, and at the end of the war, I had my little free cup of ice cream, and my wife's dancing with this sailor. What a revolting development.
Well, and your wife, who you hadn't really gotten to know yet, even though you'd grown up around each other, you didn't get to know her till after you got home from World War II. But that was the simultaneous situation. You're eating ice cream in the Pacific, she's dancing on Sunset Boulevard, and you don't realize that till how many years later?
Oh, that's quite a few. But what I think, the twin-engine bomber that crashed on our ship was nicknamed Betty. And yeah. And so I married a Betty.
A Betty almost killed you, and then you married a Betty.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Anyway, so now my dear wife has passed away and I'm alone. But I do remember one thing. It wasn't over with for me, because I took our ship, the Elmo, and we sailed down through the Panama Canal into, I think, Atlanta, Georgia, somewhere there, to put a ship in mothballs. We did that, and I was put on leave, and they come back to California, and I was traveling to California. And I stopped in Texas. And in Texas, I went to the Air Force Base and a hitchhiker ride, because I was in the Navy and I could do that, on a B-25 bomber. So these two pilots were taking some mail to California, and they said they'd take me. And so what I did is I, no seat belt or anything, I sat on top of this pile of mail going to California. And these two cowboys, but they were piloting that plane. They were really cowboys. And I remember my ears were ringing 2 weeks after I went back there. And then I was assigned to another ship, Kenneth Whiting, and they were testing an atomic bomb in Bikini Atoll. So in this test at Bikini Atoll, our ship was a seaplane tender at this time. And we had Dr. Sawyer, who was head of, he was a scientist ahead of the whole a bomb thing, and he was on our ship. But anyway, in this test, we had two tests. One was an aerial bomb, atom bomb, and the other was an underwater blast. And the aerial blast was 2,000 feet in the air, they dropped this atomic bomb. And you could really, we were quite a distance from it, but you could sure feel the shockwave, tremendous. And then on the next one, we tested a month later, I guess, or so, that was an underwater blast. And the underwater blast, we were 8 miles from it, and we could see the whole thing and watch the whole thing go off. And I remember us sailors were looking at it, and this column of water went up in the air and mushroomed out. But in this column of water that was up, we noticed a cigar-shaped object in this column of water that went up, and we wondered, what's that cigar-shaped object in that column of water? Well, I found out later on that cigar-shaped object was the battleship Arkansas. 16-inch cannons above the water line, straight up and down, blown out of the water. And I got a picture of it, and I'll show it to you later, but I got a picture of it. And so that was kind of an interesting deal. So then after that, I went aboard the Boxer for a little bit, and then I was discharged at Maryland. But I got to tell you something else. My brother-in-law, this is an interesting, really interesting story of my brother-in-law. My wife's brother, he was the hero of our family because he was a leader of all the kids in the neighborhood. They'd all follow him around. He was kind of a leader, but he'd always get into a lot of trouble. And on Halloween, the local sheriff and Alhambra, they'd lock George up, keep him out of trouble, you know, so they'd lock him up in jail. And so anyway, he joined the Navy in 1941, before Pearl Harbor, and he became a quartermaster also. And anyway, he joined the Navy, and he was on the USS Ward. And the USS Ward were sailing into Pearl Harbor at the time, and they noticed a Jap submarine in a restricted area. And so the U.S. Award sunk the submarine. And later on, you could see it on television, the conning tower of the, so you could see the bullet hole in it, big, huge bowl of oil where they sunk it. But anyway, so then George was telling me about it, and he says right after they sunk the submarine, they looked overhead and saw these airplanes flying over their head with the meatballs on the wing. And the captain, he says, full speed astern. He didn't want to get caught in that harbor, so they sailed out to sea. And right after that, the bombs started dropping off. You know, and here's my brother-in-law. He's a little guy. And so they sent him to New London, Connecticut, to be on the submarine service. So he gets on the submarine service. Anyway, he's a little guy. And while he's on the submarine service in the Pacific, he grows up to be over 6 feet tall. He was a grown boy, you know, just like the rest of us. He joined at 17 and grew up. He was over 6 feet, big guy, and strong, and nobody would mess with him even when he was little. Anyway, he gets up, and they were being depth charged in the middle of the Pacific somewhere, and the one quartermaster at the helm, he fainted. And so George took over the helm, and he stayed at the helm during the whole depth charging situation. And then he became, after that, became quartermaster first class. He served a 6-year hitch, I think it was. But anyway, what I can't imagine is you're on a submarine, 200 feet of water above your head, and these bombs going off. I probably would have fainted, but he didn't. So he's the hero of the story. So anyway, he was the hero of the family. I've known several heroes. I know of another hero that I think everybody should hear about. He was a kid who was really a rough kid in Rio Grande. He was always so nice to me. He's always Mr. Grantham this and Mr. Grantham this. But he was a kind of a mean, rough kid, except to me. And he was a friend of my younger son's. And they were a really close friend. He went and got in the Marines and went to Vietnam. And in Vietnam, he got a Silver Star, a Bronze Star, a 2 Purple Hearts. Then he was in a concentration camp for 2 weeks, and he escaped from the concentration. He lived in the jungle for about a month till he finally got back to his trophy. He won't talk about his story, but I've heard a little bit about him. So to me, that guy is a real, real hero to me.
Well, I'm sure it means a lot to him to hear you say that. And something tells me he may feel the same way about you. There aren't too many people left now who saw what you saw, and even after the war with that atomic testing. You're one of the last people who witnessed that with your own eyes, and you saw firsthand the magnitude and the power that a nuclear weapon possessed. And now they're even incrementally more powerful than that, exponentially even. Knowing what you saw, what you felt, what you experienced, how thankful does that make you that no country since World War II has used one of those against an enemy?
Well, to me, I think one of the worst inventions ever probably was an atomic bomb, because it's a scary thing even today. But I do remember after each blast, we'd sail into ground zero within an hour after they dropped the bomb, you know. And we were seeing all these little, at night, we saw these little fishes floating around, glowing. They were all radiated, I guess, you know. And I was thinking we were drinking that desalinated water. And I know my neighbor, he was a nuclear physicist at Diablo for a while. He moved, and now he's died. But anyway, he was kind of a joker. And he told them the reason I'm so healthy at my old age, because I received all those extra nukes at Bikini. So I don't know.
And the other thing that I thought of as you described what happened to the surface of the water when that underwater atomic weapon was detonated, that's not the only time you've been on some seas that were rocking and rolling. Because one thing we didn't talk about here was Halsey's Typhoon, Typhoon Cobra, the most infamous and devastating typhoon of World War II. And you got a taste of that too, didn't you?
I sure did, and I'll never forget it, because everybody aboard ship got seasick except me. It seemed like everybody was seasick except me, and I never did get seasick. But I do remember thinking that I spent a whole lot of time at the helm on that thing, because everybody was just seasick. And I do remember on the storm of the century, the swells in the middle of the northern Pacific, The swells were 70 feet swells. Can you imagine a swell in the middle of the ocean 70 feet high? And that's what we're going through with the winds, or between 150 and 180 miles an hour winds. So at the helm on that, as our ship went down into the swell, our ship would be submerged. And then it was going down at the helm. I could feel the rudder out of water. We'd lose steerage. And then we could, climbing back up again, I could feel the helm take over. And so I could get it back on course, but it was a real problem. And I do remember one thing, that a normal sea condition, the magnetic compass always swings back and forth quite a bit. But the gyro compass, you can usually keep it on course within 2 or 3 degrees. But that gyro, in this case, was really going just like the magnetica. But anyway, I had a good time, but I wasn't afraid of anything. I would be if I had to go through it today, because I'm a little more experienced. But one thing I did enjoy was when I did get some relief from the helm for a few minutes, I'd go down to the galley and help myself to any kind of thing I wanted to eat. Now, here I'm a 17-year-old kid that eats a lot in those days. I'd help myself, and then I'd get back on the helm again and steer it. And
you'd help yourself because no one else had their sea legs enough to even go eat anything?
Yeah, nobody was eating anything. No, I guess that concludes about my war experiences. And like I say, I was no hero. I was kind of a passenger aboard a situation called World War II. But the real heroes are still there, you know, on Peleliu and different places. And the Marines, those Marines, they're the heroes of the war.
Well, and you mentioned Honor Flight. You went with other veterans from here on the Central Coast back to Washington, D.C. People raise money, so you veterans get to go for free. And what you go see, a lot of things, but the centerpiece is that World War II memorial. And the whole purpose of it is to honor the guys you just called the real heroes, 406,000 Americans who didn't come home from World War II. So being there at that site, seeing all those gold stars, soaking all that in, what did it mean to you? What did you get out of that experience?
Patriotic, I think, more than anything else. When I think of the flag, for instance, the flag of the United States flag means more to me than, it's almost religious to me, because I do remember after each battle we'd have a burial at sea, and I've got some pictures on my computer about that. And when I watch these guys being buried and the flags deflating as the bodies would go into the water, you know, these are my buddies that I've been sleeping with on board ship, you know, and that was kind of a rough situation. I'll never forget that. So to me, I think of the flag with reverence. You know, to me, that flag means everything to me. I just can't imagine anybody who wanted to do anything but salute it. And to me, that's what I think about now. It gives me a patriotic feeling.
Was there anything in that Honor Flight experience that surprised you?
Yeah. All things were so informative to me. I really enjoyed every bit of it. I think that was one of the greatest things. I've enjoyed every bit of it. And it was a worthwhile trip.
Well, and we've covered so much with you. The childhood adventures that seem so dangerous to us now, enlisting in the Navy at 17, surviving the kamikaze attack, 38 years with the Bell Telephone Company, even switching entire hospitals over to new systems without interruption, all this incredible woodworking that adorns your home. When you think of all of that, I know that's a lot to consider. Is there something, though, that you would say that you're most proud of?
I think when I made the cut over St. Joseph of Orange, I think that's one of my epitome things that I did. I've had several experiences. One experience after my wife and I were married for 66 years, and she passed away in 2012. I went to the doctor, my knee doctor that I go to today, and he told me to read this book, A Proof of Heaven by Eben Alexander. And I read it, and one thing that was interesting to me when I was reading that book, he had an experience jumping out of an airport parachute with a group, and he had one situation where the chutes got tangled up, And he had a split second to make a decision. And he says, when that happens, all things go through your mind in split second, and they only have a split second to make a decision. And I thought to myself, that happened to me twice that I can think of. One time was during World War II, and then the other time I was a troubleshooter working for the phone company. But I was walking to this one house, and our test board had dispatched me that they had trouble in their phone. And so I walked to the front door, and nobody was home. So what I had to determine was whether the trouble was in the house or back toward the office. If it's back toward the office, we didn't need to make another call out there. We could fix it. So, but I had to make this determination, and the telephone lead was in the back of these houses, and so it came to the back of the house, so I had to get in the back of their house. And so I walked around to the side, on the left hand, side as I faced it. There's a passageway. One side was the wall of the house, and the other was a great big hedge about 8 feet high with thorns and stuff in the hedge. And so I walked back, and I poked my head around the corner. And just as I poked my head around the corner, I saw this great big black dog running toward me, dripping at the mouth, growling. He looked like he was going to have me for lunch. So I had a split second to make a decision. Will I make it back to that gate? No. Do I climb that the hedge? No. And there's only one thing left to do. And all of this comes in, I was thinking about a computer, for instance. It's nothing but a pile of stuff sitting until it's bought by somebody, and then a brain takes it over and make all the decisions and stuff. And that's the same way with that. Our brain is a computer controlled by our soul. And in this book I read by Evan Alexander, he was a neurosurgeon, he said that the soul takes over the thinking of split-second decisions. So you can imagine the split-second decision I had to make, and this big black dog running at me, ready to have me for lunch. And there was only one thing left to do, was charge. So I put on my meanest face, and I started screaming, showing my teeth at him. I took one step toward him, and my hands front out where I was going to grab him and tear him to pieces, and really under control then, and we're just about to crash, and his rear end went down, and he kind of slid to a stop and right in front of me, and he turned around and whimpered and went back to the fence at the back of the house, you know, and he went whimpering back there. So from that moment on, that backyard was mine, and I was able to make my test. He kept an eye on me the whole time, but anyway, I walked back and went out, nonchalantly walked back out the front yard and left him there. And I was thinking, well, my soul must have taken over and given me the right decision, because that sure seemed to work.
Well, and when you said the other one was in World War II, I'm assuming you're talking about when you got hit by the kamikaze and you had to decide whether to jump in the water or not?
Yes, that's it. Uh-huh. That was the one.
You talked about that a little bit, but just to clarify, what was the extent of your injuries? And in all these years since, I mean, 75 years about since that happened, has that ever bothered you? Have there been complications or issues because of it?
No. I do have some travel in my leg and one in my hip, and my wounds have all healed up pretty well, and that was it. So I'm fine. At my age, I feel like I'm doing pretty well.
Well, I saw you climb the stairs to give me a tour of all the incredible woodwork you've done around this place. But so what you're saying is when that bomb went off, it burned your arms and your torso and peppered shrapnel in your back and your legs. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, I got some shrapnel in my leg. Factually, the shrapnel wasn't discovered until I went to the Santa Barbara Hospital. They did an x-ray on my leg, because I had knee trouble, and there's two shrapnels in there, and it's never bothered me a bit.
And nothing hit your head at all?
No.
And despite all that, despite the burns and the wounds, you spent the next 2 hours helping other guys who were wounded before you let them do anything for you?
Yeah, because I didn't know anything was wrong with me. I really didn't. There was so much to do. It was overwhelmingly, and that was it. No, I didn't know anything was wrong with me.
Well, I just wanted to make that clear, because I know you're making it very clear who you think the heroes are, but I think when people hear that story, they might assign that word to you too. And I want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling this story that only you could tell. Is there anything else that you think we ought to know about this life you've led?
No, except that I looked at my life back, I wouldn't trade a minute of it for anything. I've done stuff and learned stuff that probably many people never will, you know. And I've been a horse whisperer, a dog whisperer, and I love animals. That's it. I just lost my dog. I'm thinking of getting another one, but I'm getting too old, I think, now for another dog. But no, I wouldn't trade a minute of my life for anything, you know. I always looking for something to do, you know, and help somebody else, you know.
Your church, and you mentioned that book that you read about heaven. Have you ever felt that God was protecting you during those years, through all those things that you went through? I mean, when you're the only guy from your gun crew that survives, is that something that you've formed an opinion about one way or the other?
Oh, yeah. I have a guardian angel, believe me. I've been protected of so many things, and my ability to build things, it's a God-given gift for sure, because I never had any other teacher. So I know that prayers are answered and that my Heavenly Father is watching over me, and I think about things like that. In fact, when you stop to think about it, every culture on earth, no matter what their religion or lack of religion, and the ancient people, they've always looked up to heaven, to a supreme being. And I'm interested in things like that. And I know that there's got to be a supreme being. And I believe that our Heavenly Father that's watching over all of us. And I'm a believer.
That is Dick Grantham, 93 years old. If you missed the first part of his story, catch the podcast online at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks to Bradley Hogan for introducing me to Dick, and thank you for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.